Welcome to the November 12, 2017 CHOW workshop on the topic Encouraging Long-Term Abstinence. Mm-hmm. My name is Sue, a grateful compulsive eater and your moderator for this workshop. I have mass muted the conference line and request that you stay muted until our question and answer session has begun. You may then unmute by hitting the star and six keys when you're ready to speak. This workshop is being recorded. Anything that does not reflect the WSO standards for workshops will be edited and deleted. Let's open with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity.
Grant me the serenity.
To accept the things
I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can. And know the difference. Thy will, not mine, be done.
Amen.
Please go ahead and press star 6 to mute yourself so we have a quiet conference. I will be the spiritual timekeeper for this meeting. The format will be the first three panelists will share for 10 to 15 minutes. Then we will have a question and answer session. Then the second three panelists will share and we will have another question and answer session. There are no assigned topics. Speakers will briefly qualify and share on what they found to be important, valuable, and sustaining in encouraging long-term abstinence in themselves and in others. So our first speaker is Paul M. Please go ahead, Paul.
Good morning. Good afternoon to some. Good morning to others. That was quick. I was looking at the format. I thought I had at least a little time to get a coffee ready. My name is Paul, again. I'm a compulsive eater from New York. I have had the luxury of meeting many of you through the phone bridge, but also by joining in at our conventions the last several years. And it's been a great opportunity for us to get to know each other. We all come in to most of the requirements of the program with one day. As we, you know, latch on and we want to do more service than they ask us to do others, including myself. And that has been one of the key opportunities for me to stay in the program. You know, I like the idea of, leading certain meetings, and they require a certain amount of abstinence in order to do that. So that is one of the reasons I stay around as I do, no matter what happens. It's interesting, I've been humming along on a song. I know it's possibly an outside issue of this song from the Beatles called I'm Fixing a Hole Where the Rain's Coming In. And that's what I was when I came into this program. I was so beaten, and I didn't even realize until a week into the program. I came in getting a sponsor, doing all the requirements, listening in that day, probably very up in the air about everything, thinking I was above all this, because for a majority of my life, I was my goal weight. I was skinny. I was like that man on the cross. I was always under. And somehow, after I got into my first recovery program, I found another crutch, and it was sugar and flour big time. I mean, it was probably always there. I know in college I lived on, wrap items that were under a dollar. And it was a doctor who told me, he said, you've got to stop whatever you're doing and start eating. And I think any recovery program I've come in and I've stayed is because I want to live more than anything. It's not that I want to stop drinking or I want to stop eating or somehow I want to give up sugar and flour. I want to live. After many years of that recovery program, I got to tour part of that, and I met a couple in my early sobriety that by the book would bring me all this unabstinent items that were in the book about giving newcomers to keep them sober. And they were just making me into that same irritable, discontented person I was trying not to be. So I came back to New York. It wasn't long before I finally hit a bottom again with the sugar and the flour. because I started ripping out of the back of my pants, and I needed to find some solace. And I had this guy I really appreciated, and he was also an artist, actor, and he had lost a lot of weight, and I asked him how he did it, and I found that he was also passing that information on to other friends from that room. So I followed another friend in who had probably a larger excess of weight to lose. He was in the 200s. I was in the getting close to 200. We stayed. At least after a week, I finally stayed. That first week, I took the plan. I thought I was going to do it my way. I was going to be able to just read out this book, figure it out, and do it on my own. But I hit bottom. It was strong enough a bottom. It was a deep enough a bottom that I didn't have to come back out again to try something else. I knew the jig was up, and I used what I learned in that first recovery program. I knew to put a skull and a crossbone on anything that came in the way of my recovery, and was shell-shocked as I started to read the labels in the back of items, how many things had to be skull and crossbones. But I did it, and I managed, and I think coming in from that other recovery program helped a lot, because I know the idea of not being able to have an alcoholic beverage with your meal is daunting for those that come into this recovery program. But I had already, you know, given up that prior to that. And it's not a prerequisite for compulsive eating to give up smoking, but I'm grateful I did that, even though that may have fueled wanting to eat more than I ever did before. Over the years, I have found myself in many places where trying to fill that hole. I have a new apartment. I haven't even put one item in. I haven't even put anything into the fridge. Before my recovery, that's what my fridge looked like. It was empty. You know, there was a light bulb in the back flashing. But I want to say that for myself, I am one to find another way to get out of myself, and that's through clutter. So I've been digging out of the old apartment in hopes that in about a month I'm going to be able to finally move into the new place scot-free, you know, almost in a Shaker-style existence, I hope, for the rest of my life, God willing. But I guess what I was trying to say is that I've always, despite, you know, the best intentions, getting up early morning, going to the 5:30 a.m. meeting, the 7 a.m. meeting, going to a live meeting on Saturdays, will find myself periodically trying to fill that hole. And so, interesting, I was humming along with the song over and over again, thinking I knew the words, and I finally picked it up thinking I'd find some inspiration for, you know, what I wanted to share. And I did, because like the apartment that I'm leaving, I have a landlord that basically tries to fill every hole here with gaffer's tape, duct tape, glue. It's never really the full intention. If they have to fix tiles in my kitchen floor, they'll pick up the one that's cracked, and that brand new tile will be amongst 37 years of old tiles. And it's just not enough. My recovery has to start fresh and new every day. It can't be gaffer taped. It can't be glued, duct taped. It has to stay clean from the minute I wake up to the time I go to bed. And I'm celebrating 14 years, by the way, but it's still, for me, still green. I have to keep it that way. I have to remind myself that this is a daily process, that every single day that I get up, I have to start fresh. So one of the things I do is I don't necessarily get down on my knees, but I'm usually down, you know, next to the dog, and I'm listening to the meeting. I'm trying to give him a little comfort. He's gotten a lot older over the 14 years that I've had him, actually the whole entire time that I've been recovered. He's also 14. So he needs a little reminder that he is loved. So when I get on the meetings and I hear other people share, especially people that I've met, I hear that I'm loved. I also know for a fact that I try at least most of my shares to send that back. And as we are getting ready for our day, the dog and I try very hard to get rid of that negative thinking that is so part of being in recovery, so that when I go out in the real world, I don't lash out, speak unkindly, raise my voice, get into fights I don't need to get into, and that is one of the reasons I also stay. Because it's not only about getting those three wonderfully well-prepared abstinent meals in daily. It is about my getting right sides with God and knowing that all of this, everything, is inclusive. So I can't leave anything out. And if I do, I usually have a bad day or something less than what I expected. That is probably one of the ways that I have stayed as long-term as I possibly can. I don't want to be the person I used to be. I'm not saying I am, and I believe it's a thing about rendering white as snow. It's not going to happen in my lifetime that I'm ever going to be perfect. And yesterday I had an early morning call. I had to show up 5:30 to feed about 700 veterans. I knew right from the get-go, despite trying to connect, getting my abstinent meal in, getting the dog out, I was trying to give him a couple more minutes, and I knew he needed them until we got up the stairs. And this woman out of nowhere comes flying down the street. She's got the full street, you know, to get around the dog, and she starts screaming that the dog's in her way. A couple unsavory words out of my mouth later, I realized I was not connecting with my higher power. So I said, okay, you need 3 minutes, I need 3 minutes, and that's all I did was try to connect before I got on my bike and went to work. So it's a food plan that works, and it's written out really beautifully in the gray book. I wish I kept it handier, but I have gotten it back in my hands, and I've looked for things that I've had to share with my sponsees, a reminder when they ask me questions about where it's located in the book, to just say that it's a very good and a very strong plan. I think that was one of the things that sold me the most, because I found myself in early recovery losing the weight that I needed, and I have remained in the same size category for 14 years, give a pound or two. I'm just grateful for that. I'm looking at the time. Do I have a couple minutes left?
You have 3 minutes.
Okay, great. So I'm going to just say that I rely on messages that either come from when I get on the phone bridge or when I connect with my higher power to say what's the next right decision for Paul, good orderly direction. Today in my travels, as I said, I picked up that song, and I started to cry when I actually read the words of that Beatles song. And there's many of them that honor love. In particular, I want to say that when I was walking the dog, I found a bag that said, have a nice day. I also am just cleaning up around, you know, the front entrance of my building. I found a coffee cup that had a butterfly on it. And these are always those little simplistic messages that tell me I'm on the right path. And today I know that I'll be grateful for the three meals that I committed to my sponsor of many years, that despite losing a mom, a dad, a sister-in-law in recovery, I've never looked for anything, including disappointing news about my own health sometimes or work issues, to ever find anything that's going to take me out, because I can't imagine it getting any better, just getting worse, if I give up the biggest and the greatest gift I ever got 14 years ago, which was coming into this program. I'll end with saying I don't think I'll ever, ever get to fix that hole to stop the rain coming in. But sometimes those holes, when we look up into the clouds or whatever, we had a hole in our roof, we can see the sun. And I thrive for it. I look for light, and I always try to go where it's green. Thanks for letting me share, Paul from New York.
Thank you, Paul. And now we'll hear from Shelley.
Thanks, Sue, for being the moderator of this workshop and for everyone that put it together. My name is Shelley. I am a compulsive eater. I'll qualify. I've been in the program absent since March 25th of 1999, by God's grace and everybody's help. That's 18 years and 7 months and 18 days a day. I am a food inventory step and maintenance sponsor. Encouraging long-term abstinence, that's through sponsoring a lot of times. It's also through doing service in this program. If I don't do tool number one, I can't do tool number seven. And tool number seven is I have to weigh and measure, I have to be a sponsor. It's a requirement. The tools are required. They're not suggested. We hear that in our See How concept reading every time we attend a meeting. And that was always something for me because this thing had to be very, very black and white for me because I use food as a vehicle to get through life. The use of it, the non-use of it, anorexic, bulimic, restrictive, a lot of people tell their story and they talk about this compulsive overeating that they did. And, you know, my overeating was, ooh, I'd have like two of a package or three or four of a package. I wouldn't let myself do that because I'm a really good self-punisher. I don't know how to live life with good things in it. I only know bad things or sad things. I can live with disappointment. I can't live with good stuff. Good stuff throws me off. In my job, I got nominated for Employee of the Year for the County of Los Angeles. And when I got that email from my director, the first thing I thought was, oh, my God, they sent the wrong email to me. It wasn't mine. And because I could not see me being nominated for that, I discount myself day in and day out. And that's this disease. Because I was always afraid of being wrong. Because when I grew up, my mom and dad died when I was a child from this disease, from illnesses caused by this disease. And that's mainly that my mother had cancer, breast cancer, and my father was insulin dependent diabetic. All developed from this disease. This disease kills people 99.9% of the time if things aren't taken care of. But food is a vehicle through life, like I said, and it's a family and socialization tool. And when I realized that in this program, I thought, oh, my God, what have I been doing with food? I'm like the Dr. Frankenstein of food. I take something that's dead, it is not living anymore, and I give it life it doesn't deserve. I'll hear people say, oh, I love this food. I just look for this food. I just love it. Come to this restaurant and have it with me or something like that. And one of my friends would say to these people, oh, why don't you marry it? And I give it life it doesn't deserve. And, you know, when I get into this program, I don't have boundaries with food that I need, and I don't have boundaries that are appropriate for me. I solve problems I don't need to solve, and I don't solve the problems I need to solve. Food will fit the bill. What I've learned is there's no amount of food. One bite will not bring a family member back from the dead, a friend back from the dead, my finances improving, my relationships improving, or my social standing improving. It doesn't even do anything for my sex life. All it is food. But I gave it power. I made it the god of my own understanding. The way I got into this program was through another 12-step program, not the beverage one, the one that loves an alcoholic, beyond all means, love at any price, peace at any price. In that program, I learned how to deal with relationships on a certain level. In this program, I learned to deal with my relationship with food in dealing with my relationship with others. In long-term abstinence, what starts to happen is clarity. Clarity at first can be a very frightening thing. All of a sudden I see the damage I did to myself and to others. All of a sudden I see how crooked I live my life. Using food is this vehicle through life. Let's take you to lunch. Let's take you to dinner. Let's celebrate with food. Let's commiserate with food. Let's do a party with food. But always food. And what I realized was no one can stand each other. Families can't stand each other, but they need the social lubricant. You look on page 151 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They talk about that. The social lubricant that alcohol brings, I can say food. Food does that for me. When you go to a holiday dinner, let's say, with a family, Aunt Betty made the best dessert, right? That's what we remember Aunt Betty for. But Aunt Betty was probably a real difficult person to deal with because she criticized everybody. But everybody sort of excused her because she made the best desserts. or Uncle Benny in the corner molested half the kids in the room when they were little. But no one talks about it. They just get to eat. It'll be okay if we eat. We can ignore. You know, and this disease is very much physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Once I get the food out of the way, this is a very important thing that's kept me absent. Once I get the food out of the way, that's fantastic. Now I got the physical taken care of. What about the mental, emotional, and spiritual hanging out in the wind? When people slip in this program, what I see them doing is only paying attention to the food and the weight. The food and the weight are guides for my sponsor to help me. I tell my sponsor what I'm eating every day and the ingredients and everything if I get a new thing, because she needs to know that, because that's her job for me. She needs to make sure I'm on the straight and narrow, which in turn keeps her on the straight and narrow. We help each other. That's what sponsorship is about. And when people don't stay abstinent, we don't have sponsors. And if we don't have sponsors, this program will die. This ain't a light situation here, friends. This is progressive, critical, and fatal. Our literature says that in black and white. I have to remind myself and my sponsees, I got to read what my friend says. I got to read the black part, not the white part of text. I can't read the blank and interpolate what I think it says. I have to look at what it says. I have to live in reality. Someone else said in a meeting a long time ago, I have to have a back surgery. I have to have my wishbone removed and replaced with a backbone. I need a backbone. I need to grow up. I didn't grow up. One of the things I remember with food and eating is food got a twisted place in my life. My mother and father came from Eastern European countries, and they were of a religion where they were persecuted. So in each of those countries where they lived before they came here, they saw people dying. They saw children die from starvation or lack of nutrition. I remember one day my mom and I, and this only came out in the writing, 30-day questions and all the writing to do. For 18 years, 7 months, and 18 days, I have been writing every day on a question every day. Can you believe that? I've had 3 weighed and measured meals every day for 18 years and 7 months and 18 days. How did I do it? One day at a time. But I remember this came out of the writing. My mother and I were doing the dishes. I was about 5. She was washing. I was drying. I remember putting a pot away down where we kept the canned goods. And there was a can of Campbell's there. And we had just had dinner about an hour ago. And for some reason, I asked my mother, can I have a bowl of that? And this is only because of the writing. I would not have this memory unless I was in this program doing the self-exploration and stuff. My mom smiled and said, of course you can, dear. Let's make you a bowl right now. Because what she got out of that was, she saw children die. This is a blessing to be in America, to be able to feed your child when they say they'd like to have something to eat. A healthy child had a little fat on him. My nickname when I was 2 or 3, I was told, was Fatsy Bumbalatsy. Now I struggled with my weight. I thought I was fat. You know, in high school, I was just telling somebody on an outreach call, I was 135 pounds. I was 5'6". But I thought I was fat. When my mom died, I went to live with my aunt and uncle because I believed my father wasn't capable of taking care of me. I was there about a year or so, and my uncle was a compulsive eater. And my aunt tried to restrict his eating by limiting all of our portions of food. I know that today because I asked some older relatives, what was it like to eat at our house? And they said, Shelley, every time we came over, we had to go eat something after because my aunt didn't serve enough. Yet I was allowed to get 2 or 3 helpings if I wanted, if I was still hungry and finished my plate. My cousins had a problem with that, but I had no problem with that. Oh, you want me to finish my plate to get another helping? No problem, I can do that. And what I was doing is probably getting a full meal instead of a third of a meal, because she was trying to protect my uncle from this disease. He ended up dying from this disease. But I'll never forget, one day my uncle decided to tell me, you're one person in this family. We took you in. We will not mold around you. You will mold around us. And the other thing he said is, you're gaining weight, and you're going to be as big as a house like your mother was. I was 11 when he said that. And I was about ready to take that man and throw him through a window. I was so angry. And I my biggest resentments were my aunt and my uncle. And you know what? They love me, even though I think they didn't. But they love me. You know why? They gave me a roof over my head, clothes on my back, and food in my belly. And that was the basics, and that's what they gave me. And I was grateful for that. They didn't intend on getting me. And through my life, I've always tried to get outside approval, always outside approval. There's never enough. Food would fit the bill to go out with friends or to be there or to when I'm bored. I was always looking for a diet with free food, the free food you can eat. And, you know, Weight Watchers had greens. You could eat a bunch of greens. I succeeded eating myself into a small bowel obstruction on Thanksgiving Day of 1998. When my second marriage, and we were married 15 years, it was about the fifth year, we were together 10 and still stayed married for five more. But my son and my son reached adolescent time and raised in a teenager's like nail and jello to a tree. But he wasn't used to children. He'd been with us since my child was four. But when he got older, he had an opinion and he was getting upset, being a rebelling and everything, and my husband couldn't handle it. And he started fighting with him, like arguing, and it was getting to physical stuff. And I thought, you know, it's Thanksgiving Day, I'm going to make a damn Thanksgiving dinner. I'm a vegetarian, they don't like the birds so much, but I'm making a big dinner, you know. I make it, I'm in the kitchen all day grazing on greens, you know, because I'm in Weight Watchers, it has a free food. I can do that diet. I end up that night with a small bowel obstruction because I ate a starch. And I called Kaiser. We were with Kaiser at the time, medical HMO. And they said, oh, get some Pepcid, see if that doesn't stop it. It might be indigestion. This was not indigestion. This was pain so bad, it was worse than labor 15 years ago that I'd been in with my son. So I went to the emergency room. They had to put an NG tube down me. You have to swallow that. So there's like eight people yelling at me to swallow this tube because you don't do it natural and they can't just shove it down. That was to relieve the pressure in my stomach and the pain. And I was on a morphine drip for 5 days. Thank God everything passed on its own. The surgeon talked to me before I was to leave. And I said, how'd this happen? Because my husband had been in AA for many years. Said, you caused this to yourself. You ate that stuff. I said, I did not. And the surgeon, who was heavy himself, said, oh, no, it was scar tissue. I haven't had any surgeries. And the only surgery I had was my tubes tied when my son was born when I was 31. So he said, oh, scar tissue. When I'm thinking, yeah, right. I did this. But you know what? This desperate act that I actually did to myself, almost dying, almost having to have a colostomy bag long-term or permanent, short-term or permanently, it wasn't enough to get me into C-HAL. 6 months later, when I decided I was going to kill myself with food, I was going to do Leaving Las Vegas, like Nicolas Cage in the movie Leaving Las Vegas. He was going to drink himself to death because he's an alcoholic and couldn't stop. I was going to eat myself to death. I said, screw it. My son is 15. He can live without me. It'll be just fine. And I started eating, and everything tasted like nothing. And, oh, my God, that scared the crap out of me so much. I called my friend who was in my other program, and she'd been on this program. I said, where's the meeting? We had no phone bridge then. So the next meeting was about 2 days later, and I went, and I ran into that room, and you know what? I stayed absent. You know why? Because I was stupid. Because I walked in that room, and the part of the meeting, where in the face-to-face meeting, they have a part where you say, will all sponsors please stand, or people, you know, who are abstinent. And everybody would identify their time of abstinence and how much weight they lost. Like we do here when we identify as a sponsor. And so many people stood up, at least a third of the room, or two-thirds of the room, I mean, stood up. And I thought, my stupidity or my naivety was, that they'll stay abstinent because why would you give this away? Later on, I found out people slip and all this stuff, but I, by God's grace in the group, I did not. And I had never been in a food program other than this one, and that was a blessing for me, too, because if I had a better idea, I'd do it. Thank you. Today, work those seven tools. That's my suggestion. You work all of them, it makes it easy. You work some of them, make it hard. If you work none of them, makes it impossible. I don't need to live an impossible life today. It's harder to work this program 99% than it is to work at 100%. I suggest when you do your seven tools, you get serious about them. This is what I did. I make my three outreach calls a day. By hook or by crook, you even have to call 25 people to get one call. I will do it. I will get three live people, even if it's a hi and a bye in response. I still got someone alive because it says in the tool it can be like a mini meeting. If I'm having a mini meeting with an answering machine or ringtones, I might have a bigger problem than compulsive eating. You know, work the seven tools. You never know how it will help you. I share a story that one of my friends says I can share and see how I'm so impressed by it. Quickly, I'll say it. She was going to break her absence. She had 2 years of absence, and there was a big restaurant thing going on that she really loved that kind of food, and she decided she took a bath. She wore a new dress. She was going out the door to do this thing, and someone called her on an outreach. It was a young mother. She said, could you please stay on the phone with me so I can finish cooking my children's meal? And just I'm finishing up my vegetables. Would you be able to do that? She says, of course I will. And she stayed on with that woman for 30 minutes, and you know what? She changed her clothes, stayed home, and stayed abstinent. And that's what outreach calls do. You never know who you're calling or what situation they're in. And please answer your phone when you get an outreach call or return the call as soon as you can, because you never know who's calling you and what they need from you. My higher power directs me through all of this. And I really recommend that everybody who identifies as a compulsive eater, please do those tools. I'm begging you, but that won't help. This is not about the weight. It's not about the food. It's about my life. It's about your life. It's about a spiritual connection with something greater than myself. I call God today. But you can call it the table, the chair, the universal creator, or people in the group, whatever you want. But please, I can't run this show anymore on my own. I did such a fine job of it. I ended up here in Compulsive Eaters Anonymous House. Best thing ever, saved my life. And I'll say this, too. I was always suicidal in my head because when my parents died, I just wanted to die. And anytime something bad went on, I wanted to kill myself. And every time I'd have an excuse, well, dog needed to be walked 3 times a day. Then my son was born. I did not commit suicide until he was 21 and he'd know what to do and everything. And then, you know what, now, when he was 21, I met the love of my life and I didn't have to kill myself anymore. But more than that, I was in this program. And I don't know a good time to die, ladies and gentlemen. I don't want to miss breakfast, and I certainly don't want to die before lunch, and I don't want to die before dinner. You know, I only get 3 meals a day, weighted and measured with nothing in between except sugar-free soda, no-calorie beverages, and sugar-free gum. And I want to wake up for breakfast tomorrow, so if any of you know a good time to die, and I'll do it, let me know. But the main reason I wouldn't do this program initially was because there was no free food. I want a friend. I want to name her Impunity, and I want to eat with Impunity all the time. I can no longer eat with impunity. I have to eat with a food plan. The Forever Abstinent book is a wonderful book. And I'll leave you with this last sentence. Fred S., one of our co-founders, said, when our food's in order, the rest of our life is in order. When our food's out of order, the rest of our life is out of order. And so it is. And so I believe it to be true. And I believe that all of you can stay abstinent, just work those tools, do those meetings, do everything it tells us to do. And you can stay abstinent. And, you know, there's always another meal coming. No one ever starved between breakfast or lunch, lunch or dinner, or even dinner to breakfast the next day. No, there's no record of that, of anyone starving to death. I wish all of you a wonderful day. I appreciate the opportunity today that Sue asked me to be on the panel. And I appreciate all our panelists as well. Look forward to hearing the rest of them. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Shelley. And now we'll hear from Judy.
Hi. This is Judy W., compulsive eater. So I have a little bit over a year of abstinence, recommitted abstinence, and have a weight release of 108 pounds. The topic was encouraging long-term abstinence through the steps, the tools, and the traditions. What I focused on was the steps and traditions. I believe that the seven tools are something that I definitely need to be accountable for each day. I had a sponsor that I used a format to read to her and report on that, the accountability piece of this self-responsibility of my part. And it definitely is true because part of my disease lies in my head, and it will always, unfortunately, remain alive and well there. And it's my perception that needs treatment. The way I get the treatment is not only the daily requirements of the seven tools, but it is through the step work that I need to be able to do and willing to do every day, a day at a time. The traditions were meant to keep the unification of our fellowship together. And I've learned through the years that without another compulsive eater, I don't have a chance to recover from this disease. But more importantly, the 12-step program and the way it was designed brought me into a personal relationship with my higher power that I've never known through religion or any other experience before. So I was looking at the big book because that's part of, and the 12 and 12 that we use from Alcoholics Anonymous, and they've really helped me to focus on the answer to my problems through the step work. And I was looking at the design of the contents particularly and how it was put together, because I feel like it was so divinely inspired by Bill W. and Dr. Bob, all the new people, that the pioneers that came in the AA fellowship. So the doctor's opinion, I thought that gave credibility to that there is an actual problem with some people when they ingest this stuff. And then, you know, it goes into the founder's story. And so I looked at that and I said, oh, that's about identification. There is a solution. It talks a lot about how I don't have the answer. I never did have the answer to my compulsive eating. And when I think that I have the answer, boy, am I in trouble. I can't solve this eating problem without the help of a power greater than myself and other compulsive eaters that have found the solution to this problem. So I looked at chapter 2 and chapter 3, and they give a lot of, you know, three particular examples of other people and why they lost their sobriety or their abstinence, and how that control has to be replaced with surrender and acceptance. Then the wisdom of the founders, knowing that we would have a problem with that higher power, right? And that's my disease thinking, because I'm all about defiance, rebelliousness, deceit, deception, omission, all those things that were such a huge part of what kept me from having continuous abstinence. I think I underestimate the power of honesty and what it can do. But yet, you know, I had the opportunity to read on one of the meetings this morning. I got the fifth step, chapter 5, that rarely have we seen a person fail. And it speaks about honesty in there quite a bit. And because of old behaviors and old patterns that I learned how to lie from a very early age, somehow I made it acceptable. It's only recently that I've realized that lying only hurts me and my higher power. It really doesn't hurt anybody else. I mean, it does, because I realize that people break off relationships with other people, sponsor-sponsee relationships. I've heard that before from our members, and I've felt that at times from sponsees. But honestly, the bottom line is the most important people know. So why I'm trying to fool myself in a lie, but it is the thing that I go to right away, and then I realize, who are you really lying to? I mean, yeah, you know, they might not find out, who cares, but you know, and your higher power knows. So what is this proving? So I've been as rigorously honest as I possibly could be this last go-around here with compulsive eating, and it's really, I think, helped a whole lot to encourage the long-term abstinence for me. And it gets rid of that negative thinking, my gosh, you know, and having to cover it up and all that stuff. Today I'm working on spiritual progress. You know, this spiritual perfection and stuff, it baffled me. I never thought I could rise to that occasion. I tried really hard, and a lot of times I think that's where my procrastination character defect came in, my isolation and wanting to hide, because I knew that as a human being, I could never measure up to that standard of perfectionism. It's not that I shouldn't try for excellence. I'm all for trying to be as excellent as possible in the way I live my life. I want to live it authentically, genuinely, humanly. I want to give others that same grace and that same dignity and that same understanding. It's really important for me to work with others. I take that very, very seriously. I try to sponsor 3 people to the best of my ability. But if anybody asks me to sponsor them, they call me up and say, you know, I heard you share and I really wanted to know if you could sponsor me. I look at that as God saying, you know what? He's tapping you on the shoulder. This is time for you to, and that's the way I, by the way, approach every service position I'm asked to do, because I didn't will myself to this. I have good behavior by those 7 tools every day to the best of my ability, but that doesn't ensure my abstinence. There is something out there that is a power of good and that's all-knowing and all-loving that has to help me not undo that good that wants to kill me. That's part of me as well. And I can do that to some degree through the 7 tools, but the transformation has to happen through the steps for me as an addict with that addict brain. That transformation has to be the help that I need in order to recover from this. And I get that a lot through prayer and meditation, mainly meditation and trying to quiet the mind and listen and be still. And I want to be unified with my fellows. I don't want to stand out as some kind of guru in this fellowship. It's not about numbers for me anymore. It's really about living an authentic life and not trying to do myself in. I know for me that the attraction of this program is the love and acceptance, and the unconditional love that I experience is more profound in CHOW than any other organization I've ever gone to. I have found that I can never make a person any better by criticism. I did not know how to sponsor for a lot of years, and I mimicked the way I was sponsored sometimes, and it was harsh. And it was unkind, and it was selfish and self-centered. And I don't want to live like that anymore. I want to live a way that is attractive to others. So the best of my ability, I love and accept people to the best that I can each day. Do I do it perfectly? Absolutely not. I do it making progress. And when I don't do it as well as I think I should, I get that knot in my stomach. It's funny how being abstinent, I feel things in my body when things aren't right away, or I'll get a headache, or it just, I know I need to go back and apologize and let people know that I was wrong. But getting back to the big book and the We Agnostics, and so how it works is chapter 5, and it's talking about working those first 4 steps, and chapter 6 is about 5 through 12, and then the next chapter is on working with others. And I really feel like those steps and the way they're designed have transformed and encouraged me to live this way of life. I find no need to take that first compulsive bite most days, and I'm very grateful for that. And I know it's because I get the opportunity to fellowship with all of you, and because my higher power has some purpose for me in this world, and I think it is to remain abstinent and to demonstrate a solution that works. And it's a solution, as the wisdom of the book authors wrote. It's a solution. It's not the solution for everyone. So I just want to attract who God means for me to attract to this fellowship and to encourage as many people as possible for long-term abstinence and recovery. And I want to thank Sue for asking me to be a speaker on this meeting. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Judy. Now we're going to have a question and answer session for up to 10 minutes. Please press star 6 to unmute yourself. When you've finished asking your question, please press star 6 to mute your line. The response time for answers to questions posed by a caller will be 2 to 3 minutes and decided upon by the panelist responding. Just a reminder that you're being recorded, so please do not give your name when asking your question. And there is no abstinence requirement to ask a question. And just to let you know, any speaker may respond to a question. So go ahead. Do we have any questions?
Yes. I was wondering why we have all the other books. Why don't we just do the steps and the seven tools and let that be it? Why we have the book with questions about Bill, as Bill see it and living, so all those other books. Thank you.
Paul from New York, can I briefly share?
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, it starts with the tools. It starts with our general, you know, understanding that there is work ahead. And then see how I have procrastinated periodically on my questions with my sponsor, literally having to do a dozen tradition questions before I could actually be part of, prior to the convention, the actual conference, because it was mandatory and it requested. I think out of all the programs I've ever known, this is one that has requirements that ask you to follow suit. And part of it, without using food terms, because in AA they often, and I identify with like the whole and the, you know, that item, that we're peeling layers. And we're not sure what questions are going to be the ones that do the deed. But I found over the years of doing question after question, I'm peeling layers and I'm letting go of negativity and other sources that are not needed for my abstinence. So I'm grateful to go out of the box. I'm grateful for a fourth-step program that was beyond my wildest dreams. As far as finishing that, it beat out anything I'd ever done in any other recovery program because it asked questions and triggered emotions, yes, but to get through certain things that I could let go of and to keep my abstinence, which is the most important thing.
My name is Shelley. I'm a compulsive eater.
Go ahead, Shelley.
There's a lot of feedback on your end, Sue. I don't know what that is, but you sound like you're on a CB or something when you're talking, but I don't know what's going on. Anyway, Shelley, compulsive eater, to answer the question about all the literature is conference approved. We use all AA literature, substitute the word compulsive eater for alcoholic and food for alcohol. You identify absolutely. The questions that we do are written by members in a group, several members of the program. Some of it was written by two of our co-founders. It's all designed to uncover, discover, discard, to work through that physical, and the physical we do with the food plan, but the mental, emotional, and spiritual have to be dealt with. When you look at, there's four things, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual that our program touches. Or some people just say physical, mental, and spiritual. All those things go into each other to help us stay abstinent because we can't leave one thing unattended or two things unattended that will get us compulsively eating again. I've gotten a revelation lately about the idea that my belly button birthday is October 10th, 1953. The best day of my life was October 9th, 1953. I was warm. I didn't have to breathe air. My mother did that for me through the amniotic fluid. My mother was with me all the time. It was very nice, quiet, serene, better than you could ever expect. And I was never hungry, angry, lonely, tired. October 10th, 1953, oh my goodness, it's cold. I have to breathe air. People are poking me, prodding me, putting a diaper on me. Now I'm dirty, I'm pooping myself, I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired. And then for a moment, I get one of three choices, my mom in a bottle, or somebody with a bottle. And then it's October 9th for a real short period of time, and after that the war is on. And then my addiction begins. and because I'm never finding that place of comfortability again. I am always fixing the, I'm trying to fill that hole that was mentioned a while back by our other speaker with food instead of a higher power. And that's why my life gets crooked. I can't solve things with food. The only solution that food is good for is if it's a mealtime and I'm hungry, then whether I'm hungry or not, but in our program, but it's a mealtime. It's because I'm hungry and for nutrition. That's the problem food solves. All other problems solving with food just twist my life around. I didn't qualify before my weight, but God has graciously released 54 pounds from me. And I've been maintaining that for 17, 18 years because I got abstinent about the eighth month into the program. You know, using this literature is really helpful and also a reminder that any of us can write on our writing on the phone bridge and siha.org. You can look up the meditation book that we're writing, and you don't even have to have any abstinence to write a submission, but you write it on based on any of our program literature, and they will look at it and they will do the grammar and spelling. You don't have to be a fantastic writer to do it, and we will have a book of our own, daily meditation book. And that would be a wonderful thing to do, and anyone can do that, like I said. And doing service, that's what this is all about. We are just alcoholics eating solid food. That's all. An alcoholic can have an ear of corn, but they can't have corn whiskey. It's too concentrated with many ears of corn in it. And essentially, everything boils down to my compulsive eating. When I get rid of everything else, I'm compulsively eating. And the literature addresses everything. Look on pages 62 and 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. That talks about 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. Look on pages, thank you, pages, I think it's 53 and 54, or 52 and 53, of it's the end of step 4 in the step book. It's from our twisted relations that we can't have a relationship with anyone, you know, because we've taken every precious relationship and made it something it was never supposed to be. And then we argue for our limitations. These things have been very important in my recovery to start to uncover, discover, discard. And I get little epiphanies all the time, little spiritual awakenings. You know, don't leave before the miracle happens. Just because someone has 18 years doesn't mean, you know, life is full of wonder and greatness. Look on page on the story, God is Good, in the Came to Believe book. I can't be absent and live in utopia. Life is still in session. Things happen. People die. People are born. Divorces happen. Marriages happen. I got divorced and married in this program in this last 18 years. Thank you. So hope I answered the question. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who'd like to answer that question? Why do we have the other literature and why don't we just do the steps? Do we have another question? Go ahead.
I really didn't need to say anything. I think it was covered well. I just wanted to, I think the literature is really, it helps me with the questions that the literature, the AA literature has. That's all, really.
Okay, let's move on to our next speaker, who is John. Go ahead, John.
Thank you. Thank you, Sue. I'm John Yu from Missouri, grateful recovering compulsive eater. Abstinent since July 17, 2014. I'm a food inventory step and maintenance sponsor, having released 165 pounds along the way. I was born in Burnville, Indiana, population 75. It was a one-street town with two alleys and dogs all around. And I grew up surrounded by my mother's Irish Byrne family. Our history went all the way back to Dublin, Ireland. It was a richness that is dying in our world today. I even knew my great-great-grandfather Byrne. We lived on the ridge overlooking the valley, and it was a very simple and a very secure life. The doors to our house were never locked. I in fact, never remember a key being in the house at all. The keys to our car were always hanging in the ignition. I lived a life like John Boy Walton. It was a whole other world. Not so today. If I don't lock it, I will most likely lose it. If I want to go to a CHOW meeting, I must remember the key fob to my car, the pass key for the secure door to our apartment building, and the key to my apartment. I'm even required to lock my apartment if I simply want to go across the hall and visit a neighbor. Trust is a big issue in our world today. Not having the right key, being locked out of your car or your building or your apartment, can be most painful and very costly experience. Your progress for that day comes to a screeching halt. The parallels between my everyday reality and my CHOW recovery are very significant to me. I will use the three A's, awareness, acceptance, and action, as a structure for my share. I had no real awareness of my compulsive eating for the first 73 years of my life. In the last 44 years, I did see my weight yo-yo go up and down, finally go way out of control, ballooning from 175 pounds to over 365 pounds. I still believe that my problem was I just ate too much, including way too many sweet things, and that I exercised too little. I had no clue that I might have a life-threatening disease. CHOW brought me that awareness. I am a compulsive eater. For me, this is the most important key which unlocks my long-term abstinence. When I'm tempted, when I want to pick up, this basic key gives me the needed checkup from the neck up. I remember that I am a helpless, hopeless, hapless, compulsive eater when I give in to my addictions to sugar and flour and quantities. I remember that at 365 pounds, with a 58-inch waist and a 3X shirt size, taking 12 to 15 prescriptions, I was literally destroying my life by eating myself to death. I keep that image vividly in my mind. Great motivation. I was fortunate to have three live meetings to attend, and those meetings and the love expressed in them made me keenly aware that God always had been there for me and had and was now doing for me what I could never do for myself. I saw in the members of my group a lot of recovery, hundreds of pounds lost, much loving service and compassion for others. They introduced me to the AA literature and the CHOW program and the food plan. Awareness of that knowledge brought me great joy. For words are very important to me. They've been important since I learned them at my mother's knee. Somehow, without actually seeking it, I began to have hope that the keys that my friends in the group were using could help me find the release from negativity that had created my own personal self-made hell. Awareness that we do together what we couldn't can never do alone, and the awareness that reaching out to my fellows in service were essential keys for my long-term abstinence. The Big Book tells us that acceptance is the answer to all our problems. Page 164 of the Big Book says, see to it that your relationship with Him, namely God, is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. This is the key to acceptance for me. We deal in facts. Facts, not feelings. Feelings are not facts. In other places, we're told our program is not suggested, but required. Only recently have I begun to put feelings in their proper place. We've all got them. For me, my feelings were the opposite side of the coin to my negative ideas. My ideas didn't work, and it took me 73 years to find this program. And in this program, I found a God idea which has changed my life forever. Growing up, one of my favorite programs was Dragnet. Sergeant Joe Friday had this classic comment. He wanted just the facts. Just the facts, ma'am. You know what those facts are. We share the same disease. We know the see-how concept and how it works and the steps and the traditions and the tools. And we know that abstaining from sugar and flour and quantities is just the beginning of our recovery. We know that ours is a spiritual program. We say the Serenity Prayer at every meeting, and it's the Serenity Prayer that has taught me to be aware that our progress is spiritual as well as physical, as well as emotional. And that serenity comes from God. We become aware of that fact every time we repeat the prayer asking, God, grant me the serenity. And then acceptance kicks in, to accept the things I cannot change. And then we have to take action. The courage to change the things I can. And then we have to apply awareness, acceptance, and action all together to use wisdom to know the difference. What a God-blessed program I have found here. I grew up perfectionistic, very negative, very unworthy. So unworthy that girls were a complete mystery to me, although I had three younger sisters. I was very, very lonely because I could not see how God could love such an imperfect person as me. That's the beauty of See How to me. That's what encourages me to have long-term abstinence. That's what keeps me coming back and keeps me trudging the road to happy destiny. That's what keeps me in the fellowship of the Spirit. What a beautiful thing to talk to another compulsive eater. I think Bill W. said, that's when recovery begins, when one alcoholic sits down and talks with another. That's the significance of the outreach calls that we make. We boost our recovery with every call. There are so many things that we accept. We've got slogans. Slogans like, halt. Don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. I add a T on the end of that, halt T. Don't get too thirsty, because those becomes cues which get us on that slippery slope. Recovery has really become a magic thing for me. The word magic could represent, M could represent the message that we have. Zig Ziglar once wrote, you are what you are where you are because of what has gone into your mind. You change what you change where you are by changing what goes into your mind. And that's what Sihau did for me. It replaced the stinking thinking messages that were running over and over in my mind with this beautiful program where there are spiritual awakenings, where there is joy and freedom, where there is happiness, where there is things that I never dreamed possible until I could accept my compulsive eating. I could not stay abstinent unless I accept life on life's terms. I cannot be happy. I need to concentrate not so much on what needs to be changed in the world, but what needs to be changed in me. In my attitude. G represents gratitude. Melody Beattie's writing is really appropriate. Gratitude isn't a tool to manipulate the universe. It's a way to acknowledge our faith that everything happens for a reason, even if we don't know what the reason is. The big book tells us that nothing, absolutely nothing, happens in God's world by mistake. It goes together to create the character which we have in recovery.
1 minute.
Thank you. Let me just say, in conclusion, the Jedi Master Yoda, do or do not, there is no try. I've been trying all my life, trying and failing and trying and failing. The message for sustained abstinence that I leave with you is just do it. Stop trying. Just do it. Give the service. It releases you from the bondage of self. Make Sihau your number one priority. Work the program hard. Go to any length. Always take God with you. Pray the Serenity Prayer, the Step Prayers, the Lord's Prayer, any prayer, even the simple, help me God. Thank you, God. Thy will, not mine, be done. I'm John Yu, grateful, recovering, compulsive eater, Independence, Missouri, 816-489-8033. Grateful to be able to serve today. Thank you, Sue, for asking me.
Thank you, John. And now we'll hear from Ginger.
Thank you, Sue. Could I have a 5 and a 1 minute more warning, please?
Yes, I'll do that.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Ginger, and I am a compulsive eater and very honored to be asked to participate in this workshop. A little background history. I have been a compulsive eater mostly my entire life, and I didn't have a weight problem growing up because I was so physical and active. Didn't really have a weight problem until my 20s. I was excellent at dieting and could lose weight with the best of them, tried as many different diet plans as I could find, but my problem was that once I got to my what I believed was my maintenance weight, then that was an invitation or a green card for me to go forward and eat like I had eaten before. I came into our sister program in 1989. I stayed there for 22 years. During those 22 years, I lost 50 pounds, kept it off for a number of years, but never surrendered, never did what was asked of me. I manipulated the tools. I made them fit my way. You know, sometimes people come in to see how and they say, oh, I needed a guided food plan, you know, that tells us specifically what to eat. Well, I had a more rigid food plan in one of the programs I was in where we didn't have sugar, flour, artificial sweeteners, or caffeine. And I manipulated that to change it to how it worked for me, and that didn't work. I came in to see how in February of 2011. I came in to release 10 pounds for my son's wedding, which was the following May. Through the grace of God, I had a spiritual awakening that happened on a phone bridge meeting. At the time, I live in Phoenix, and at the time, we had one face-to-face meeting. I went to the meeting with a friend who was my eating partner. She was more of my diet partner because we were in program together, and we were always scheming and trying to think of different ways to work the program, different ways to lose weight. None of them really worked. None of them were successful. And she told me that there was a new kid on the block. Well, it really wasn't new, but it was new to us, and it was CHOW. So she had gone the week before me, and then the following week I went with her. And, of course, this might not surprise anyone, I stuffed my face as much as I could before I went to the meeting because I knew I wouldn't be able to eat that food for a while. And notice the word a while, because it was not my intention to work this program the way it was written. It was not my intention to stay with it. I just wanted to get a little bit thinner for my son's wedding, and then, you know, that was going to be that. But on one of my first phone bridge meetings, when the concept was well read, it was like, oh, the tool steps traditions are not suggested, rather they're required. Now, in our sister program, we read that, and I had gone to hundreds, thousands of meetings, who knows, I don't want to embellish, but I had heard that passage read a lot. And I never was able to personalize it. I really believed that I was working it the way that it was written. But that evening when I heard it, it was like, oh, I need to surrender? Okay. So I surrendered and I did what was asked of me. And a miracle happened. Before, I always felt like I was a martyr, that I was doing a program that, look at all those normal eaters. I'll never be a normal eater. I'll never be able to eat like that. Wine, wine, wine. And that's with an H, not without it. Thank you, God. Thank you, God, that I found CHOW. Because finally, I had serenity around food. Now, I have been in since February of 2011, so I'm getting close to 7 years, so that's an exciting thing for me one day at a time. I'm a food inventory step and maintenance sponsor. In this program, I've released 16 pounds all together. between 40 and 50. But what's amazing about this program, what's amazing about CHOW, is, and I really believe whatever 12-step program you were to find, that it would work for you if you worked it. If I would have done what would have asked of me that first day I came in, I probably never would have learned about CHOW. But I didn't, and I did in CHOW. There's a little bit of background noise going on. Sounds like someone just washed their hands. But anyway. Okay. All right. Thank you. So when I came to CHOW and I finally surrendered, I did what was asked of me. And, you know, service is not anything for me that is new, because my parents taught me from a very young age through example that if you are involved in something, then you need to be an active participant in it. So when I came in to CHOW, I began doing service immediately. You know, reading at meetings. After 7 days, my sponsor said I could share, so I shared at meetings. After 30 days, I volunteered to lead meetings. I became a sponsor. And, you know, becoming a sponsor can be really scary. And what I love about being a sponsor in CHOW is I don't need to know all the answers. If one of my sponsees asks me a question and I don't know the answer, I can say, let me get back to you. I need to check with my sponsor. And my sponsor I've had for over 6 years, what a blessing that's been. And she doesn't become impatient with me when I ask her something and that I might have asked her before. And I've started writing things down that are real questionable to me that I, you know, that I know I've asked her before. Okay, I have to write this down. So my Forever Abstinent book has lots and lots of notes in it, because that's how I operate. I have to have it written down to understand it. And so I did sponsor. And I didn't have to do it alone. And so if you're getting close to your 30 days and you do your step-up ceremony, don't be fearful. Don't be fearful of anything in CHOW, because CHOW really is a compassionate program. There are our people, we're human, and so do we like everyone? No. Do some people, when you hear them, does it feel like your fingers going over a chalkboard? Yes. But you know what? We can hang up the phone. We can go to a different meeting, whatever. We are not like so tied that we are committed to a certain meeting and we have to attend that meeting. Most often when someone is upsetting to me, you know, what they say is very true. It's because that person is bringing out something in my personality that I need to look at. And that's, you know, that's one of the gifts of the program. In this program, what I've learned is that I need to do God's will in my life, not my will. And for anyone who knows me from meetings, and I'm an early morning person, I'm usually on the meeting, the 7 a.m. or the 5:30 a.m. meeting. Those are my most regular meetings. A couple of years ago, I was working, I was close to retirement, and I had a principal who didn't value me. He was new, and he didn't like any of the old-timers. And so he did everything he could to get rid of me. And you know, through the grace of God, this program preventing me from opening my mouth and telling him where he could shove it, where the sun doesn't shine. I remember being in that meeting thinking, horrific thoughts. And then it was like, let go and let God, let go and let God. I heard my sponsor, let go and let God. And I breathed. I didn't say anything. And I got to retire with full benefits. What a great gift that was. And then that very, very first year when I was retired, my daughter adopted a beautiful baby that she got at birth. And there was a problem with when the birth father found out that he actually had a baby, because he wanted it aborted, that he wanted to have control. He wanted the baby, even though he didn't have a job. I mean, I don't need to go into the details. The details are that I want to share is that I didn't know if I was going to have my grandson in my life, and I was his primary daycare person because my daughter is single and works. And so I had this baby, and I said, how am I going to love this baby with the fear that he's going to be taken away from me? And, you know, I'm used to Thank you so much. I used to pick up and eat over the most ridiculous reason. Oh, I was a teacher. Oh, I have to do report cards. I need food to get me through that. Oh, my husband looked at me cross-eyed. I didn't make a traffic light. Something broke. All of those were valid reasons for me to pick up. And then see how, by surrendering, I learned that it doesn't matter what happens in my life. Food is not going to make the situation easier. So it was almost 2 years before our grandson became officially my daughter's son, my grandson. And during that time, my prayer, and sometimes my mantra, because I needed to say it all the time, was, "Thy will be done, and Lord, let me have acceptance." And I was able to pray for the birth father, and I was able to say, "Bless him, change me." And I was able to trust that God was going to get me through whatever I needed to get through, and I didn't have to pick up, because until I surrendered in this program, I did not trust my higher power. I thought I knew better. I thought I had the answers to everything, and I've got to tell you, I didn't have the answers to everything, and my life was not a wonderful life. Today, I have serenity. Today, when something goes wrong, I mean, I still might have that little, the hairs on my neck stand up, but hopefully I'm not going to respond. I'm not going to play into anger and fear. And if I look at all of the things that have gone wrong in my life, fear is the number one reason. And why do we have fear? Because we don't trust in our higher power. See How is an amazing program because it's progressive. We don't just suddenly get cured, and we're never cured. We are always one bite away from a binge. But service has helped me. Just like I said, how you don't have to sponsor alone because you have your sponsor to help you and that person's sponsor to help them. And that's great. But service also has helped me stay abstinent, because when I get depressed or I have negative thoughts, it's being of service to others that has allowed me to get out of myself and really to be the hands of God, because that's what we talk about. And when I came into program, I mentioned I led meetings, I sponsored, I became an intergroup rep, and then I was at an intergroup meeting and the secretary wasn't there. I volunteered to take role. I was quite honored when they asked me to be secretary. My sponsor, I checked with her, and she said, "Yeah, do it." I became secretary. I did that for 4 years. I became an area rep. I became a delegate. I was on the board of directors. I was the vice chair, thinking that I would just move into the chair. And my husband that had surgery, had spine surgery, and he was facing 4 more surgeries, he said, "Ginger, could you please back off on your service?" You guys, I have to tell you, that was one of the hardest things, because I just thought I needed to do all these things to keep myself abstinent. Well, in praying and talking to my sponsor, I decided I wouldn't run for re-election, and then I would just slowly, whatever. But it was a scary thing to do, and I did it. Consequently, I have also withdrawn from some other boards in the community, and I have more time now. But I'm thank you so much. I'm still doing service. It's just at a different level, a different degree. And if I can encourage anyone to consider doing a service that you haven't done before, leading an after meeting, volunteering to be a leader, volunteering to read, giving your name and number. That is so important at a Fold Bridge meeting. So this is a beautiful program. We can't keep our abstinence if we don't give it away. We have to trust in our higher power. We have to do what's written. Thank you very much, Sue, for asking me, and thank you for allowing me to share.
Thank you, Ginger. Now we'll hear from Steve. Steve, are you on the line?
Good morning, everybody. My name is Steve. I'm a compulsive eater. I want to begin by thanking Sue for asking me to participate in the workshop today. And thanks to all the other participants, as well as those who asked questions and will ask questions at this meeting or this workshop. Let me just begin by identifying My abstinent date here in Seattle is July 21st, 2004. 13 years, 3 months, and 18 days of back-to-back Seattle abstinence. I'm a food and sponsor. I maintain a 115-pound weight loss here in Seattle. I do have a sponsor, and I do have a home group as well. You know, the idea of quote-unquote long-term abstinence and how one gets that, very simply, and I stay abstinent over a 24-hour period, one day at a time for the amount of time that I just mentioned. It's really, really that simple. I use the 7 tools, and when I was thinking about every day, and when I was thinking about what's got me to this point, you know, just share briefly on each one of the tools, that when it comes to our tool number one, weighing and measuring, yeah, my food has always been weighed and measured day one. The other thing that I do that's a little bit different maybe than other people in the program is that in all the time I've been in program, I have not eaten in a restaurant more than maybe about 4 meals out of all the meals that I've had over the last 13 years, 3 months, and 18 days. Just 4 have been in a restaurant. And that was early on in the program, and those were also weighed and measured and where it was with abstinent food. Just me, maybe here, maybe some others don't eat in restaurants as well, but I find that even though our literature says something about not weighing and measuring in restaurants, I find that to be a slippery slope for myself. So I avoid the whole idea of eating in restaurants altogether because of what the program says. I know when I first started the program that I like to have variety in my food, and I used to make all my meals for a 7-day period. And one day, it would take me like 4 or 5 hours putting all this stuff together and cooking and preparing and whatever. Now I've got it down where my food is so simple and has been for years that you can call my sponsor. You can tell you what I had a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And he can probably tell you what I'm going to have over the next 2-3 years as well because the breakfast, lunch, and dinner has not changed. It's been the exact same food items over that period of time. I find that the simpler I make my food, the less I have to worry about it. And another important principle with respect to the food that has helped me over the years is that when in doubt, keep it out. I get calls from sponsees over the years saying, can we have this? When I say, I don't think so, they try to find ways that they can get that particular food item. But I know myself, I've done that as well early on in the program, tried to find out why something is not allowed, why it's not on the food plan and how to get it on the food plan. And my sponsor early on beat it into my head that when in doubt, you just leave it out. That's what I've done. When it comes to meetings, yeah, I go to 3 CHOW meetings a week, and it's been that way from the get-go. I tried to convince my sponsor that because I was in some other 12-step fellowships that I should be able to count some of those meetings and then for just go to only like 1, maybe 2 CHOW meetings. He just laughed and said, you go to 3 CHOW meetings in addition to all the other meetings that you go to. So it goes to be 2. And not to crosstalk, but maybe just to piggyback on what Ginger had just shared about meetings, I heard something years ago in another 12-step program, if you like everybody at the meetings you're going to, you're not going to enough meetings. I find that to be solid advice, you know, that you're just the way that these programs are. Obviously, somebody will rub us the wrong way, but it's not an excuse to not go to the meeting. In fact, I find that if I don't like somebody at a meeting or I find myself getting, God forbid, resentment about somebody at a meeting, I make sure I stick with that meeting until I work through that, and usually it's something with me that I'm disturbed about something going on in me or about that person, but it's really a disturbance in me, not anything to do with them meeting. We do go to 3 meetings. We do the reading and writing, and it's a challenge after a while to find something new to write on, so thank God there are the people that come up with new sets of questions, new sources of literature to take a look at, different way to look at the same thing. That gives us some fresh material to keep working on. You know, going through the literature, doing the reading and writing, putting things down on paper with a pencil, not with a computer, but me with a pencil and a piece of paper is very, very helpful. It gets out that stuff between my ears, get to share it, get give it away. You definitely don't have to hold on to keep it. Yeah, we make 3 phone calls a day. I love making phone calls in this program, especially to people that I know I haven't heard from for a while, either on a meeting or have not seen or have not heard from. A lot of times it'll go something like this. I'll call and go, oh, thanks for calling me, but I'm not in the program anymore. And then I'll call them a month later, and they go, like, I told you I'm not in the program. I wish you wouldn't call me. You know, have a nice day. Third month, I'll call them, and they'll go, it'll go something like this. Thank God you called me. I need to get back to the program. You know, I keep making the phone calls regardless of what the reaction or the action is on the other end of the line. You know, it doesn't say, make 3 calls to people that are happy to hear from you. It doesn't say make 3 calls to people that are absent a certain amount of time. It doesn't say make 3 phone calls to people that are having a fantastic day. It says make 3 phone calls to people that are in our program. And as far as I'm concerned, once you come to a meeting and you openly claim that you are a compulsive eater, you're in the program. May not be abstinent, may try to leave the program, but with me, you can't leave. You know, it's just the way that it is. I don't like to see anybody be forgotten. I have old phone lists from years ago where I'll call people and they'll go, I've been away from the program for years. Maybe it's time I got back. So we never know who we're going to affect by making these phone calls. But I know that I stay abstinent by making the phone calls. Yeah, I practice anonymity. I'm married to a compulsive eater. And I'll go to meetings, and people will say hi to so-and-so. And I said, you're free to call and let her know yourself that you want to say hi to her or what. I said, I'm not going to say who I saw at meetings, who I heard at meetings, what was said at meetings. It's just the way that it is. If you want to find out what went on at a meeting or that particular meeting, you have to have been at that particular meeting if you want to know what went on. But I do find that with a lot of people that I get close to, I do tell them my last name. So many times we tell people our first names, obviously. Hopefully it's the right first name. I have people give me the wrong first name. Later on, tell me what their real first name is. But over time, we give people our last names because, God forbid, when we should be in a hospital, you show up and you go, I'm here to see Steve. And I go, Steve who? We got about 10,000 of them here. And, you know, the guy that's in CA, how? Oh, that one. You know, because I don't put down on admittance form or any other information in what 12-step program I'm in. So if you don't know my last name, you might not be able to find me. But I do share that with people that I have confidence in that I get to know during the program. And I have been of service. I've been in service from everything from assistant timekeeper at a meeting all the way up to managing the World Service Office for CA House. So I've been involved in service at all levels. Right now I'm the treasurer for 2 meetings here in Long Beach where I live. I find that it's good to stay in service at any level, whether it's the group, the area, intergroup, world service. It's very healthy to be in service. I do have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. And I've been fortunate to have the same sponsors since I started the program on July 21st, 2004. That's just the way that it has worked for me, that I haven't had to find another sponsor or seek another sponsor whatsoever. I find that's been a very, very beneficial thing here in CAA, continually having the same sponsor. So it's been good. And all my sponsees, sponsor people, I won't sponsor somebody unless they're sponsoring people. I won't sponsor people unless they're working all 7 tools. And I find that by doing that, I sponsor people that work the program like I work the program. But once I let sponsees begin to, quote-unquote, cut some corners, do things a little differently than I do, they start working a different program than I'm working. And the only program that I work is the CAL program. So as long as they're working that program, I can sponsor them. When they start working other programs, even their own, they need to find somebody else. So I keep my sponsorship the same as I'm sponsored, and I find that seems to work really, really well. So those are some of the things that I use. And the other thing I'll say is this, is that, you know, people that have been around for a while, when I talk with newcomers, they ask me, like, well, when does the program change that, you know, you do this or that? And I said, it only changes with respect to the food. We have the first 30-day program. We have the after 30-day program. And then we have maintenance. And I know that they're asking me something about, like, well, when you get a certain amount of time, do you get to go to less meetings or make fewer phone calls, or you don't have to weigh and measure, or you can eat this, or you can't eat that, or do this, or do that. And, you know, we have one program here. The seven tools is not divided into the basic seven tools, the intermediate level seven tools, and the advanced seven tools. It's just the seven tools. It's just like our 12 steps. It's the same thing. It's designed to produce a psychic change in the individual such that over a 24-hour period, one does not put excess quantity, sugar, or flour into their system. And I find that works no matter how much time you have. That's the way it goes here in the NCA. How? So like I said in the beginning, I do this thing one day at a time. And I know something that's been very important to me that's affected other areas of my life is something that one of our co-founders, Fred S., said, that when I get my food in order, I get the rest of my life in order. And that's definitely happened today. So, with that, thank you for allowing me to participate in the workshop today. I'll turn it back over to our facilitator. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Now we'll have a question and answer session for up to 10 minutes. Please press star 6 to unmute yourself. When you're finished asking your question, please press star 6 to mute your line. A response time for answers will be 2 to 3 minutes, decided upon by the panelists responding. And just a reminder that you're being recorded, so please do not give your name when asking your question. And there is no abstinence requirement to ask a question. So who would like to ask a question?
Hello. I'll go first. Thank you all for your wonderful, wonderful talks today. This has been a terrific workshop. And my question is directed to John. John, you had an acronym to the word magic, and the M was for magic, for message. G was for gratitude, and I didn't get the other ones, A, I, and C. Could you give us the acronym for gratitude?
Yes. The A was simply acceptance, and the I was insight or inspiration, or both, and the C was character.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Would anyone else like to ask a question?
Yeah, are people not leaving their telephone numbers on this workshop?
You can leave your telephone number if you like. However, if you'll contact me, I'll give my number at the end of the conference. You can get the numbers for the speakers from me.
Okay.
This is Cheryl, compulsive eater.
Go ahead, Cheryl.
I'd just like to clarify the CHOW guidelines, and those are, I guess CHOW does allow us to eat out at restaurants or any place. Question.
Hi, this is Ginger, and I'd like to mention that, yes, we are allowed to eat out at restaurants. It's just a personal choice if someone chooses not to do it. I know for me, my first 30 days, I went to the airport to visit my aunt who was, you know, passing through town. I thought I'd be there for 2 hours, and we ended up spending many hours, and I needed to eat a meal. Through the grace of God, I had a sponsor who was available, and he knew the airport I was in and was able to say, go to this restaurant and have this. And so it is a personal choice. For me, personally, I like restaurants. I find them, they work. I also find that when I go to a restaurant, if the food portion isn't right, I immediately take it off my plate and put it someplace else because I can't handle the temptation of having more food on my plate than what I can eat. My sponsor doesn't have a problem with me going to restaurants. If I go to weddings, I call in advance to find out what the food is. I bring food with me. Sometimes I eat before I go places. This is a program that works for me for life. Thank you. And this is Ginger.
Would someone else like to answer on eating out at restaurants?
Yeah, my name's Shelley, compulsive eater. In the beginning of my program, I did eat in restaurants occasionally, one particular restaurant that had everything I knew I needed. I weighed and measured it. They weighed and measured it all the time. But eventually, I eventually became vegan. And once I took the dairy item out of what I was eating, I felt sick after I ate there. And I don't know what they put in anything. I remember one of my first sponsor was telling me she watched a cooking show, and they were barbecuing a piece of protein, and then a plate of just plain sugar, and they dipped, they did one side, the other side, put it on the grill, and cooked each side. Then they did another side, you know, another layer, and then until they did seven layers like that. And if you went to a restaurant and asked them for that protein, and you, they may not, the waiter or waitress may not know how it's prepared. They said, oh, yeah, it's just barbecued plain. And I don't know how they're preparing it, how they're storing it. Sometimes they take water and sugar and put it in a spray bottle, and that keeps greens from withering or from turning brown so fast. So I don't know what's on anything. And these days I do not eat in restaurants. I don't want to make someone else responsible for my food. Only I'm responsible for my food. I know what it is, I know how much it is, and what I do. Is that strict or restrictive? You know, it's very freeing because I don't have to wonder if I'm absent or not. I've traveled to Australia, and I looked up grocery stores before I went there. They were able to buy everything I needed. Thank you. And it is a choice. It is allowed. That's just what I do. And thank you.
I had one other person that wanted to speak on eating in restaurants.
Hi, Steve, compulsive eater. I apologize for creating any kind of controversy at the workshop, but it is a workshop, so we're just expressing quote-unquote personal opinions, not the opinions of C.A. Howe. And I did state that the program does allow one to, when I share, does allow one to eat in restaurants. It's just my personal choice that I don't, so I apologize if anybody was confused thinking that because I don't eat in restaurants that was following CA Howe guidelines, that eating out, eating in restaurants is allowed on the program, and what you eat is also a personal choice, and what you don't eat is a personal choice as well. I was just stating what works for me since I was asked to share on what are some of the things that have helped me and quote-unquote get long-term abstinence here in CHOW. So I'm not trying to create any controversy whatsoever. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And the program does say also that when in doubt, leave it out, and that we should avoid our personal triggers. So going to eat in restaurants is, in my view, a matter between you and your sponsor. So do we have another question?
This is John. I'd like to say one other thing about that question.
Go ahead, John.
Eating in restaurants is a great place to have an emergency kit. I have one in my car. I keep one in my car. If I had an office, I would have one at my office. My experience has been I'm still eating the over 30 plan, and I've dabbled in maintenance, but my sponsor and I have agreed that over 30 works for me, and so that's what I do. There's very few restaurants where I could afford to get the food that I need. I would end up having to spend $25 or $30 for a meal in a high-class restaurant in order to get the number of ounces of vegetables that I need and such. And I take my scale right into the restaurant, and there are certain ones, there's one or two in Kansas City that I can eat at. The rest I just don't frequent. And if I have to, I eat out of my emergency kit. And I take it right in and join in the fellowship and just eat out of my kit. That's all I had to add.
Can I just say one last thing? I know we got to close. This is Paul from New York. When I was 1 year abstinent, or
so close. I went on a trip with my mom, and on the Champs-Élysées, I had a huge blowout. And I realized, you know, one, I got to a meeting. Second, I made sure that I had my provisions no matter where we were. So in Prague, my mom and I were sitting in a restaurant, and I pulled out my scale. I put it right there on the table, and I had my abstinent meal. And I never saw her so proud of me taking care of myself and being able to be out there in the real world abstinent. And that's all I have to share. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Paul. Do we have anybody else who wants to talk about eating out in restaurants or even having an emergency kit, which was a good point brought up by John? Okay. With that, we'll close the workshop. Thank you to all for participating in this workshop today, including our speakers who graciously extended themselves for speaking at this workshop, Paul, Shelley, Judy, John, Ginger, and Steve. You can contact me after the meeting if you want telephone numbers. My number is 702-480-2248. That's 702-480-2248. I'm in Pacific Time Zone. Thank you for allowing me to be your moderator for today's informative workshop. And let's close with the Serenity Prayer after a moment of quiet meditation for those who are still suffering in and out of these rooms. God,
grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can,
and wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, everyone.
I will not mine be done.
Not mine be done.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you, everyone.